Hello. I'm Melanie Tate, and this is A Country Podcast, where Kim Lester and I talk about the social and cultural impact of the phenomenon that was a country practice, and occasionally look at the 50 shades of grey of Dr. Terence's hair. Kim, talking about social impact, we've got another set of big issue episodes to look at today, haven't we?
Do we ever? We've watched the last four episodes of season seven. They're called License to Kill. And oh my God, Mel, there are a lot of realistic looking dead birds in this one, aren't there?
There really are a lot. We've also got a guest I'm really excited about. In fact, it's a must listen for those amongst us, and I know there are quite a few, who dreamed of being a child star, because we're chatting with Emily Lyding Waite, who was the adorable Penny Richards.
Oh, I'm so excited. Let's get into it.
So, Kim, when you settled down to watch these episodes, you sent me a bit of a panicked message. Can you share it with everyone?
Yeah, I think it said something to the effect of, oh, crap, I've chosen a four-parter.
You sure did, Kim.
I'm sorry.
And I must say, my heart sank. And it felt like a really long four episodes too. I felt like I could feel myself aging during these episodes.
Yeah, they probably could have cut things down a little bit, couldn't they? I mean, there were two key plots that developed across these four episodes. I guess without them, everything else just could have been condensed down to two episodes, couldn't they?
I don't know why it was four episodes. The only reason I can think that it was four episodes was because it was a really, really important issue of the day. I remember a Neighbours storyline about this issue
yes,
as well.
Yes.
So we should probably, maybe we should just get stuck into it. What do you reckon?
Definitely. So like I said, there's three key plots to discuss in this recap. One, it's the beginning of two major ACP relationships, Joe and Michael and Terence and Alex. Joe and Michael don't actually get together, but we, the viewers, are being warmed up to the idea of them as a couple. And I can kind of see why they need to warm us up, because Joe is still 17 at this point, and it does seem like a little bit of an inappropriate relationship.
Yeah, I've got some thoughts on that, Kim, that I'm really excited about sharing.
Okay, and Alex and Terence kiss, but they are they a couple by the end of episode four? I can't actually remember.
Who knows with Terence? I mean, again, we were texting with each other. Would you like to share what you texted to me when I said, what the hell is Terence doing to Alex?
I'll do that in a minute. I'll find that text for you while I'm also doing this recap. Anyway, romances aside, park ranger Kathy Hayden is put between a rock and a hard place when she finds lower than average numbers of wild ducks in her annual survey. This means that she has to reduce the bag count for the upcoming annual duck shoot, although she'd probably rather cancel the season altogether. She comes under attack from pretty much all angles. The business owners and the hunters aren't happy, and someone takes their anger out on Kathy's horse by shooting it with a particularly cruel hollow head bullet. Meanwhile, we meet the Spencer family, Dave, Marlene, little Phoebe, and Dave's overbearing father, Tom. And by the way, Tom is Baker Mackay from season one. Did you pick that?
I did not pick that. He couldn't be a more different character, could he?
I know. I was watching him thinking, this guy's familiar. I've seen this guy in something.
Yeah, I thought too, but I didn't sort of even dig into him for our extra person. Wow, yeah. That's amazing. Well spotted, Kim.
Baker Mackay, in case you don't remember, his wife was killed when she was skipping town to run away with his best mate. That was in series one. Anyway, Tom and Dave are gearing up for the shoot, and the night before, after they've had a few too many, Tom puts Dave's loaded rifle in a broom cupboard and talks him into taking something more powerful with him on the hunt. The next day, little Phoebe opens the cupboard and the gun falls out and shoots her in the chest. Ultimately, they realize not only is Tom Spencer responsible for this accident, he also shot Kathy Hayden's horse. And Mel, when I was watching these episodes and Phoebe was shot, you started texting me about something completely different at that moment. And if I seemed rude or short or just particularly tense in that moment, just know that that's what was going on.
I'm going to have to go back. It'll be something like, Kim, my life is in meltdown. Please help me. What's going on?
What do I do about this? My response is probably just like, yep. Got it. Fine.
Oh, that's so funny. It was a pretty intense episode. How intense was it, that second when Phoebe was shot?
It was really, really full on. I, because I guess a lot was happening actually in my house as well, because I think you were texting me and my kids were coming in, you know, it was just like, there was too much to process. But I mean, you knew that was going to happen. As soon as he put the gun in the cupboard, you knew that little Phoebe was going to get shot. At least I could see that coming from a mile away, but God, it broke my heart. And just, and then it was a really intense surgery that she had to have, that they had to perform on her. And he was, Tom Spencer was being this really overbearing, you know, presence in the hospital waiting room, blaming Marlene for everything, even though it was clearly his fault.
What sort of gun was it and who does it belong to?
Well, it's mine. It's a 22. I use it for rabbits, things like that.
And you left it lying around loaded?
I don't know how that happened. I'm usually very careful with guns.
Well, somebody wasn't careful enough. Common sense should tell you to remove the ball from the rifle and keep it in a different part of the house.
Calm, Alfred Gilroy. Our kitty's fighting for her life in there. This is no time to be giving us a lecture.
I'm really annoyed that Dave didn't speak up in the hospital waiting room. Afterwards, after they'd left the hospital, he confronted his dad about the gun being loaded and put in there. But he didn't say anything to Frank and he didn't say anything to anybody else. So he kind of covered up for his dad as his dad was essentially attacking his wife. I really didn't like the way Dave came off in that situation.
Yeah, but he did. I mean, he had his moment at the end. He did. Yeah. He did grow towards that, which is something. The thing that I found really interesting about it, Kim, is do you remember when we were kids? I feel like kids being shot by unlocked guns was a really common story.
Oh, I don't think it's a really common story now, in America at least.
Oh, in America for sure. Mm. But we just never hear of anything like that now. We just don't have that gun culture that is ever present and that is very much on display in this.
Well, our laws are just so much more strict now. And that was, you know, I did actually toss up between whether or not to do gun laws or duck shooting, because obviously I think gun laws in Australia are actually just a really key part of our history as well. Like, you know, of our recent history that will always be memorable for me, which obviously came off the back of the Port Arthur massacre. But, yeah, I think our laws are just so much more strict. I know people who own guns. Mm-hmm. They would not dream of putting a loaded firearm in an unlocked cupboard. Like they just...
Oh, my God, no.
No, they're so much more responsible than that.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's a thing that's happened as a result of our laws or whether some people have just always been very, very aware of...
Maybe, yeah, maybe. And, you know, probably there was a lot of education that came with the gun laws as well. But also, I guess we live with – gun owners in Australia live with the knowledge that this is something that can be taken from them very easily, whereas the difference in America is what is it going to take for them to actually introduce any kind of reasonable gun laws? Whereas here in Australia, we do have – the political will to say if there was a series of children being shot by loaded guns falling out of unlocked cupboards, I think we all know that governments of the day, there would be enough political will for governments to introduce much more stringent policies to ensure that that didn't keep happening. Whereas that's just not the case in America.
Well, no, they've already had a whole heap of that. Sandy Hook. Yeah. If they didn't do anything after Sandy Hook, they're not going to do anything, are they?
Yeah.
I often wonder, like sometimes I think to myself, did we need somebody like John Howard who just so believed in his own ideology regarding everything and just so happened that he was anti-gun? Like, thank God, because like look at what he could, you know, he's conservative. It's amazing.
I do think it is something that needed to be introduced by a conservative party. I think it's one of those things that if a progressive party had it tried to introduce those laws, they probably would have come under attack by the conservatives because that would have represented the conservative vote. I just think it's easier for conservatives to introduce progressive laws than it is for progressives in some ways. Because do you know what I mean?
You're so clever, Kim. You're so clever. Yeah, it's so true. So when you're a politician, if you do decide to go to the Liberal Party for that reason, I'm 100% voting for you.
Do you know my husband used to say, when I'm Prime Minister, and I just used to say, I am never going to be the Prime Minister's wife, I can tell you that.
You might be the Prime Minister, Kim, though. That would be wonderful. Vote one, Blester. It would be great. Kim, one thing that was really stark about this episode was the gender dynamics in it. Didn't you think? Like, I really felt like we were watching something in 1987.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it was discussed all the way through. First of all, there was the treatment of Kathy as the female park ranger, a woman in a man's world, trying to prevent predominantly men from enjoying their sport. And so she came under attack as a woman.
She even had her colleague say, and I'm not listening to a girl like you.
Yeah, that's right. But then also in amongst all of the arguments about the shoot, so there were protesters. There were a group who protested the shoot. And a lot of lines, I think Shirley said a lot of stuff, you know, most women don't want anything to do with guns. And there was just a lot of mention in the writing about this divide between men and women and being pro-gun and anti-gun. Did you notice that?
Yeah, actually, now that I think about it. And in the language around the protests as well, it was like everybody was emotional.
Yes.
And they were, you know, pull your wife in, Frank, all this kind of stuff. But, yeah, you're right. I don't know if I noticed that as much as you did until you said now. Like, yeah, women were the antis and men were. But, of course, in great Wanton Valley style, everyone comes around by the end.
Yeah, that's right. And everybody came around. Nobody could defend shooting Kathy Hayden's horse. Like at the end of the day, when everybody found out, and it was revealed in the pub in front of everybody that Tom Spencer had shot Kathy Hayden's horse, and he was kind of saying, yeah, well, you know, what did you expect? And he was sort of trying to defend himself.
Gather friends.
Yeah, and it became very clear that that did not sit with anybody.
Yeah. Mm. Particularly not Bob, who had been pro-duck shooting the entire time, and he just thought that was too much.
I find this so funny with horses. Isn't it interesting that nobody could accept the cruelty of shooting Kathy Hayden's horse, but they were doing the exact same thing to the ducks?
Look, that's the whole argument with animal rights everywhere. Like, I'm sure I'll get lots of unhappy messages about this, but and I know that whales are endangered, but every time everybody goes off about whales, I think if you don't eat steak at night, fair play. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Then be angry. It's sort of, I just don't feel like, I don't understand why it's okay for us to eat sausages, but it's not okay for me to chop up Mabel, my dog, and eat her when she's, you know, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Animal rights is such a complicated thing, isn't it? I was just talking about this with a friend, actually. We're just talking about this exact thing. And she was saying, you know, how can we, with cows, you know, maybe we can't fall in love with cows. And I thought, I bet you can. Mm. If you nurse a cow from the time it's a calf and you see it grow and you, of course, like that you wouldn't be eating that steak. Like it's really complicated, isn't it?
It really does come down to our cultural relationship that we have with certain animals.
Anyway, we should move on to the relationship aspects of this episode.
Yes.
Who do you want to start with, Michael and Joe?
Well, I don't know I haven't seen much of Michael and Joe as a couple. So you've seen the wedding, you've seen a lot of their episodes. What do you think about them as a couple?
Well, as a kid, can I say that as a kid, I feel like, I mean, I must have only been seven, but I feel like I had my first boyfriend, girlfriend feelings about them. You know, I know that's very young, but I was always a bit boy crazy. And Michael and Joe, I used to just dream of being them. I just thought that, you know, because he was a little bit older and she was young and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know, in a 2021 view. So in the episode, if you haven't watched it yet, dear listener, Joe accidentally stays overnight at Michael and Kathy's house while he's helping her with her driving test or something. And everyone starts talking it because Beverly spreads the news that Joe has been deflowered by Michael at the house. So everybody's had a gossip about
it. Which she hasn't been, by the way.
No, she hasn't been. It's all it's totally innocent. And Shirley, I love how Shirley is always on the front foot of every argument kind of thing.
She's so chill.
You can tell she wouldn't have cared if they slept together at all, don't you think?
Absolutely.
She's so chill. So everybody in town is having a go at Michael. When he goes into the bar, they're all sniggering at him. Joe gets teased at work. In a way, like he's 26 or 27 and Joe is 17. Mm. So I kind of think in my 2021 view, I think the people in the bar were right to be a bit like, Michael, you dirty dog.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people were awful to Joe, absolutely. The way the nurses treated Joe.
I'm not into
Joe,
that at all, no, obviously.
That was awful. That was,
yeah. Particularly those older nurses saying, what have you got that I don't have? Like, that was off. And she's a young girl and, you know, she's a baby. Yeah. So that was off. But Michael, I think, is not quite as, like, a 27-year-old, 26 or 27-year-old coming onto a 17-year-old is a bit posh.
Which wasn't actually what happened in this one.
No, but it happens.
At some point it will happen that they'll get together. Will they? This is an opportunity for the fanspurts. What do we want to call them? That's a terrible sound.
I love that. Fanspurts is great.
That sounds a little bit dirty, doesn't it?
But I love that. How appropriate.
This is a great opportunity for the fanspurts to tell us on our Facebook page. Is Joe 18 by the time they get together? How do they
I can tell you this, Kim, because I've watched it. They get together because Michael has a really bad bike accident in the next series, and they fall in love while she's nursing him, and they get married very soon after. I think she's 18 by the time they're married. Right. So it's I guess okay. But, you know, I can remember when I was 21 having a boyfriend who was 29. He was so embarrassed to be going out with someone so young. I think that's why we didn't stay together. He was so embarrassed. I was so immature. Like, he wouldn't introduce me to his sister. And I even this one time over Christmas, just rocked up at his house. Was overseas at Christmas when his sister was there to meet his sister. It was awful. Like, just because he's embarrassed because I was so young and such a baby.
But he was probably embarrassed about himself, within himself, not embarrassed of you. Yeah. Like, he probably felt like
I think it was a little bit of column A, a bit of column B. But, I don't know, it's a bit 17-year-old.
Mm.
Like,
I definitely wouldn't feel comfortable 17 with it these days, but yeah.
All right, and if you had a 17, when Olive's 17, how would you feel about her coming home with a 26-year-old?
Oh.
You'd just think he was a little bit gross. You would. Even if he's a lovely, handsome nurse like Michael Langley, you'd still think he was a bit off.
Yeah, I'd be having a lot of, I'd like to think I'd just be having a lot of conversations about the whole situation. I'd like to think that I wouldn't be saying, you two can't see each other, because that would get nobody then they anywhere. Would for
sure. Yeah.
But that we'd be having a lot of conversations about, you know, consent and protection and whatnot. And yeah.
Oh my God, so full.
But we
on.
Should be having those conversations anyway, really.
We should in every relationship.
Yeah, and this is what modern day parenting is being, you know, much more willing to talk to your kids about sex and consent than previous parents were.
Oh my God, did you ever hear the word consent when you were growing up? I didn't. I mean, I did. My mother used to say to me, don't you dare have sex. If you have sex, I'll be able to see it in your eyes. And then I would have these dreams, Kim, where I'd have sex in these dreams and I'd walk around, my mother would walk into the room and I'd have my eyes shut, like not wanting her to see my eyes because she'd know I'd had sex.
All I'm going to say about this is that my mum is listening right now, just on what's the like, she's so nervous to think, what is Kim going to say about what I said?
Yeah.
Don't worry about it, Mum. I'm not going to say anything. It's all good.
Oh, I can't wait to hear. I'm going to be texting you during the next episodes you're watching to find out what the sex talk was in the blisters. Can I tell you one other great thing about the sex talk in our house?
Yeah.
So Mum gave me my mother's always been very much like, don't go near people who make you feel uncomfortable. Mm. And we were very brought up that if somebody was inappropriate with us, you know, like that was bad. And if they said it was a secret, that was bad, you know, like all that kind of stuff. But she, when I was going through puberty and starting to get into like those sorts of things, she gave me Where Did I Come From and What's Happening to Me books, but she ripped out the wet dream pages and the masturbation pages.
Do you know, I take it back, Mum, because I am going to tell a couple of stories.
Great,
so she was much more sex positive than even she realised because – so I've got three sisters, right, and I'm pretty sure that we had all read Flowers in the Attic by the time we were 12.
Oh, wow. So you knew about having sex with brothers.
Oh, yeah, we knew all about
it. Yeah.
But Mum read it like 5 years ago. She had no idea. She read it and she's like, oh, my goodness. Oh my
God. It's not just sex, that's incest sex.
She was horrified.
Oh, that's great. So did you get your sex education from Flowers in the Attic?
Probably.
Kim?
I know. Yeah. We had Where Did I Come From as well. And I remember, I can vaguely remember showing one of my friends that book, which probably would have, I'd be feeling a bit mortified about that if one of my kids did that.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that if mum and dad had seen me doing that, they would have felt a bit mortified too.
Did you have Judy Blume's Forever, you know, with the sex pages?
I never read Forever, but I read, which is not exactly the same thing, but I read Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, which is more about puberty.
It's periods,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah, that's periods. Right. Well, Forever had a sex scene and had a penis that was called Roger. So I used to think, oh God, you got to come up with a name for penis. Not that I ever got anywhere near a penis until my 20s, but good times, rock and roll. Anyway,
moving on. We better briefly touch on Terrence and Alex.
Yes, but I'm worried because this conversation has become a bit sexual.
It has become a bit sexual. So, okay, you texted to me, OMG, the friend zoning from Terrence was your text.
Oh yeah,
to
so
me.
So can I say, hang on, I've just lost my thing.
That's all right.
So anybody who knows Kim and I will know I am expert in being friend zoned. My entire romantic life is having been friend zoned. And so the friend zoning that Terrence gives Alex is out of control.
It really is.
So it was a pleasant end to the evening. And all's well that ends well.
Oh?
And the fact that kissing me out of a spontaneous gesture of friendship was a pleasurable experience, well, that's a feather in my cap. Thank you, Alex. Yeah, you've made me feel years younger.
Terrence.
And there's no harm in a kiss between old friends, is there?
I do think it's because he feels
he's older.
Too old for it.
I've been friend-zoned by older men too.
Yeah.
Just so you know, I've been friends. I've had this experience that she's having now, so that's why it was.
It's so awkward.
So awkward.
So you've written OMG, the friend zoning from Terrence, and I wrote, and after she endured another one of his drunken monologues, stay away, Alex. He's a hot mess, isn't he?
He is such a hot mess. I hated that monologue he did. I actually thought it was a bit out of character.
Well, except that he did it to her early on. Remember, he had the drunken monologue in the Bethany episodes?
Yeah, but at least that was about something, you know. It was about him being lonely and about losing the child, whereas this was like, it was like perhaps, and I doubt that this happened, but who knows, that Shane Porteous is like, I want to go off and do Hamlet. Let me go. Like, I want to get out of this show and spread my damn wings. And they're like, don't leave us, Shane. Like, we'll write you a Hamlet to be or not to be monologue.
We'll give you a playground as a stage. And you can read a monologue. It's fine. Just be drunk.
Exactly. Just be drunk and have the most sort of self-centered bloody Barney. I can't believe who'd want to pash someone after that. I would not want to pash him after that. And I want to pash him basically in every episode I ever watch. So I just don't understand. Would you want to pash
him
after that?
I thought that was such a turn off. Ugh. Being drunk and monologued at is just the biggest turn off.
And about being a phony. The whole monologue was about being a phony, and he's not a phony.
Yeah.
Dr. Terrence Elliott is not a phony.
No, I mean, because a day or two later, he removes a piece of a child's lung to save her life. So he's
only doing the surgery once and being a GP.
Yeah.
Like,
he's a bad drunk. But anyway.
Only a 25-year-old would fall in love with
exactly.
Like that. You know, like there's no way. There's no way anyone else would be.
Yeah. The only thing that would make me feel more awkward than that drunken monologue is if he picked up an instrument and sang to me.
Oh. Awful. Awful. Can I say, Kim, that is about the worst thing a bloke can do. And you just have to sit there.
Ugh.
Any one-on-one music.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Barbara Jones Streisand, if I was in a room with her, I could probably hack that. That's about it.
Would you come away afterwards and go, I just don't think I love her anymore. She just made me feel so
awkward.
She
looked at me too deeply in the eyes.
All right, Mel. We're a little off the rails here, so should we?
Yeah, so are we pro? Anyway, are we pro Alex and Terrence?
Oh, I'm.
And how it eventually.
No, because it just, I don't think he is a good partner for her. I think that a lot of people.
He's a hot mess.
He's a hot mess. He continues to be a hot mess throughout their marriage. Granted, some very tragic things happen, but I'm not happy with the way that it ended for them. I think that he should have been prepared to go and chase her dreams with her for a little while. I don't think it's, mm-hmm. you know, good enough.
I know,
that
we're not quite over that.
Because, you know, that's part of a marriage is to take on adventures
and
together.
And also he's 150 years old by that stage. So, like, it's not like he had
poor
to.
Shane.
Oh, no, Shane. We're talking about Terrence. Yeah. We know that Shane Porteous, we feel like he would go. Complicado. All right, shall we move on?
I think we'd better.
Oh, by the way, one other thing. Did you freak out when you saw so the little girl gets shot?
Yeah.
And the episode ends.
Mm.
And then next episode written by Judith Cahoon.
I missed that. She has one for killing children.
Yeah, she loves killing children. And so I must say I saw that and I was like, no, Brooke Mikey Anderson's about to die.
But no, I mean, we also know that Judith would much prefer to save a child's life than kill it. So maybe she got her way
this time.
Of course,
but I think she did because maybe they just didn't want to stump up with the wine. You know what I mean? She's like, no. All right. Kim, social issues for days. What are you going to talk about?
Well, yeah, like I said, I thought about doing gun laws. I reckon a gun storyline's going to come up again at some point. So there'll be another chance to do gun laws in Australia. So duck hunting, I chose that one for a couple of reasons. More on that in a moment.
So, Kim, it didn't take any lives in a country practice, but it did take Kerry's life in Neighbours.
I know.
Around the same time.
I think that's the TV death that stayed with me the most.
Me too, aside from Donna Manning.
Mm. Yeah.
So you remember that really clearly as well?
I remember Kerry's death, wasn't it? Really clearly. Maybe it's because of she had a little baby, Sky.
Oh, and Joe, her hapless husband.
Joe Mangle. What a guy.
Yeah.
What a guy. And he had Toby.
Oh, gosh. They were a little mixed family, weren't they?
Yeah. They were a great little family. Poor old Kerry.
And he was a bozo and she was so lovely. And
he was a bozo with a heart of gold, though, wasn't he?
Oh, a bozo with a heart of gold, of course.
Anyway, these four episodes aired over 2 weeks from the 9th to the 17th of November 1987. Probably the biggest story at that point in time was the Black Tuesday stock market crash, which had just happened on the 20th of October. Mm. That was the massive stock market crash that set the ball rolling for the 1990s recession in Australia. The Australian share market lost around 25% that day and 41.8% of its value by the end of October. I mean, holy hell. Yeah.
Crazy.
Insane. It's also the dying days of Joe Bjelke-Petersen's reign of as Premier of Queensland.
But you're going to say his reign of terror.
it was a bit of a reign of
Queensland.
Of terror. My dad had a shirt for like most of my childhood. My dad had a shirt that said, "And on the eighth day, Joe created Queensland," which I think says it all really about growing up in Queensland. So, yes, he was deposed by the National Party at the end of November. And during the first week of this four-parter, La Bamba by Los Lobos was the number one single in Australia. But the following week, it was knocked off by Electric Blue by Icehouse and Mel.
What a great song.
Both great songs. My son loves Electric Blue and we listen to it on the drive to school very often.
It's so great.
It's such a banger. And La Bamba is like on my pick-me-up morning list. Like, you know, instead of listening to the news of a morning, like most serious people do, I go, bugger that, I'm going to listen to dance music.
I can't listen to that without thinking about that. The reason that was back on the charts is they did a movie about him at the time, and I just remember the mother getting the news at the washing line going, Richie, Richie, not my Richie. So every time I hear La Bamba, I think of that.
Oh.
Not my Richie. So it's not on my pump up list.
I'm going to have to watch that movie.
No,
I did know
you'll
about
have to
it,
take the song off your pump off list, so don't do it.
Yeah, right.
It's probably not very good either. This is a 7-year-old that loved this movie.
Like I said, Mel, there was kind of a key reason why I decided to choose duck hunting for this episode. It's because I found an article about duck shooting from 1987, actually from the 17th of November 1987, so when episode 4 went to air, nothing to do with a country practice, but it really made me appreciate the accuracy of the way that the show was written. So these episodes really covered the issue from basically every angle, like animal welfare, population management, local tourism, and the economy, the local economy, and gun safety all get a mention. And it all actually rang true in terms of the arguments for and against duck hunting of the time. So this article was by the then Sydney Morning Herald rural writer Peter Frey. He went on to be the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. And he was reporting the issue, like I said, at the same time that these episodes went to air, because the New South Wales government was gearing up to consider whether or not to ban duck hunting on animal welfare grounds. So once again, a country practice is right on par with what's going on in the real world. An inquiry by the New South Wales Animal Welfare Advisory Council, which was a government council that answered to the New South Wales local government agency department, local government department, was winding up, and it was expected to come out in favour of the ban. And at the time, about 100,000 ducks a year were killed in the annual shoot. And it was estimated that between 10 and 20% of ducks were not immediately killed by the shots, instead dying a much slower and more cruel death. So if this ban had gone ahead, they would have been the first government in the world to ban hunting of a wild animal purely on the grounds of cruelty.
I'm worried because you keep saying if it had have gone ahead, so I'm guessing that it didn't.
No, duck hunting season in some parts of Australia is actually kicking off like this week. Yeah. So more on that in a minute. Another key concern from conservationists was the protected water birds that wound up in the firing line, also something that was depicted in A Country Practice with all of those hopefully rubber dead birds in the episode. I refuse to believe that they were real ducks.
They look pretty real to me.
The groups in favour of duck hunting were sporting shooters, the gun lobby, local businesses and rice growers because of the damage that ducks would do to their crop. One of the...
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Which,
like, there's always an argument, isn't there?
There is always an argument. I think that there was an argument, though, that there were more effective measures to prevent damage to crops than shooting ducks and population management. There were actually other things that could be done, like scaring them away and stuff like that. One of the arguments from our favourite panto villain, Councillor Muldoon, was the impact to the local economy if the Wandon Valley shoot was reduced. And actually, he was kind of right, Mel. According to Peter Frey's article, more than half of the 11,000 active shooters in New South Wales were from Victoria. The Australian hunting industry in general was worth $50 million a year, and he cites the example of West Wylong, whose local economy saw a $30,000 injection each year from the shoot.
Oh, wow. Right.
So it's a tough one. It's actually a pretty tough thing. I mean, your parents own a shop in a small town.
And my parents at the moment are going through something like this because they're about to do a bike race through the middle of town and cut off town for 2 days so no one can go into my dad's shop.
Oh, really? But the bike race isn't bringing people to town?
Well, they said that they've done it before and apparently it's meant to bring people to town, but everybody just rides through. Like there's no...
They don't stop.
No, they don't stop. So yeah, it's kind of... it's interesting, isn't it, that argument seemed pretty potent. Like, and when you looked at how busy the pub was for Cookie and, you know, people were... That's why... Like old psychopathic, narcissistic Baker Mackay, Daddy Spencer was in town because he was visiting for the shoot.
Yeah, that's right.
So people like that were going in buying beers and having duck Cleopatra and the like.
Yes. Now, Mel, I just have to read this to you. This is direct from the article. The shooting lobby also believes man's right to hunt is sanctioned in the Bible. In Genesis, God blessed Noah and said, "All the animals, birds, and fish will live in fear of you. They are all placed under your power. I give them all to you as food." Shooting associations, almost exclusively a male domain, also argue that man is essentially a hunter and without the right to hunt would lose his sense of identity. Animal welfare groups, which in turn are dominated by women, point out that the human race has evolved to the point that hunting is not necessary for survival.
Well, that's very ACP on on point
as well.
Aren't
they just right on point with the gender dynamics and all of it? And Mel, like I'm actually not anti-gun, but I don't think I've ever heard an argument from a gun lobby that didn't make them sound like a self-absorbed teenager throwing a tantrum. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Like honestly, have you ever shot a gun?
Never. Have you?
Yeah.
Is it fun?
It's powerful. Like it's, yeah. I don't know if I'd call it fun. But my 9-year-old went and shot a gun over Christmas. He went with.
Oh, yeah. What did he think? Because he's such a gentle soul. What did he, how did he feel about it?
Oh, I think he found it, you know, interesting and exciting. And, you know, yeah. He didn't shoot an animal. He shot targets.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was in a really controlled situation with his uncle and his dad. Like I guess I'm just wanting to sort of put forward that I'm not actually anti-gun. I think that there is a place in the world for sporting shooters and property protection, you know, like not property protection as in killing human beings.
Who into your property. You mean like killing
like
rabbits
like pest like control. Sorry. Yeah. Pest control. I don't know property what the right
protection.
Word is.
If somebody comes to my front door, I want to have a gun to protect my family.
I would much rather kill a human being and complicate life for myself than have them steal my computer.
We shouldn't laugh, should we?
Oh, anyway. Oh God.
So what's the sitch now with duck shooting in Australia?
Well, this is the one thing that really didn't ring true about the episode is that duck hunting season in Australia tends to run between March and June rather than, you know, end of November. The duck shoot wasn't banned in New South Wales in 1987, but three states did eventually ban duck hunting. WA in 1990, New South Wales in 1995, and Queensland in 2005.
I can't believe Victoria didn't after Kerry died in Neighbours.
I know. It really didn't work, did it? Because that's still going.
Yeah.
It's, wow. And it's huge. Probably biggest in Victoria, I think. It's still legal in South Australia, Tassie and Victoria. Each year, data is gathered to determine the sustainability of a shoot and its likely ecological impact, and the relevant authorities use that information to regulate the season. So this year, the University of New South Wales survey showed waterbird breeding was at unsustainable levels, especially among game birds. So in Tassie, the season will run for 3 months from the 6th of March and their bag limit is 10 birds a day. South Australia's season will go from the 20th of March to the 27th of June with a bag limit of 4 per day. And Victoria will have a much shorter season this year starting on the 26th of May, going for just 20 days with a limit of 2 head per day bag limit. So that's kind of the lay of the land now for duck hunting.
So interesting. Rest in peace, Kerry. Mm. I'm so glad we didn't lose Kathy Hayden or someone like that in this episode.
Do you know what's interesting about Kerry, though, is if you stuck with Neighbours as long as I did, you would have seen Kerry make a comeback in their 20th anniversary. I think she came back as a different character. It all got a little bit soapy. I mean, you know, more soapy than it already is that year. I was living in a share house at the time and that was kind of like a fun thing that my housemate and I used to do was watch Neighbours.
And it was and Kerry came back.
Kerry
so
came
great.
Back. Paul. That was when Paul came back. Like all of the 1980s characters came back Amazing. To Neighbours. It was actually a really fun year.
That sounds fantastic.
No worries. All right, Mel. It's your turn. Apart from Baker McKay, who else stood out for you in this episode?
So 4 episodes long, Kim, I thought that I would focus in on the person who probably became the biggest TV star of anybody on the episode, of the guesties on the episode for our generation, certainly, and that's Brooke Mikey Anderson.
Yeah, she was a familiar face.
She was, wasn't she? So this is actually the first television appearance of Brooke Mikey Anderson. The reason we're talking about her and that we know about her is she'd go on to do another guestie on A Country Practice and then be stolen by Forrest Redlich, who was actually the producer of this episode, for E Street to play Penny Cook's daughter Claire Fielding on E Street. As a blester, you surely all wanted to be Brooke Mikey Anderson, didn't you?
I think as a blester I wasn't particularly aware of her name, but I definitely recognised her face from E Street.
God, I feel like she was so famous when we were growing up, like that name Brooke Mikey Anderson was really, really famous. Mm. According to Wikipedia and IMDb, she was born in 1981, but I'm not so sure about that, Kim, because the ep we're watching is 1987 and don't you think she seems younger than 6?
No, she seems – my daughter's almost 6 and she seems about that.
Is she? And that she's about that size? Okay. So she was born into a showbiz family with a capital S, Kim. Her grandparents were a traveling duo of whipcrackers.
That is brilliant.
Isn't that great? Her mother, Linda Keane, ran an acting school, and it was an acting school that in the ads that I found on newspapers.com had coached two Logie winners. Not sure which two, but it had coached two Logie winners, mainly focused on kids with a troupe called the Keane Kids. And I found an ad advertising a show called Trouble in Nursery Rhyme Land with the Keane Kids, Linda Keane and Greg Anderson, who is Brooke Mikey Anderson's dad. Now, he's an interesting one. He is the Electric Cowboy. Have you heard of the Electric Cowboy?
No.
He rides around in big venues, like big stadiums, on a horse, all lit up in lights because electric. And on his showreel, he's on stage with like Glen Campbell and Dolly Parton. So I suspect he's probably one of those, you know, when they have a fight or something like that, they get a bit of entertainment between bits and pieces. That's him.
And it sounds like a rodeo entertainment you might find at the rodeo or something.
Yeah, exactly. But all the pictures, so his showreel is really interesting, and we should link to it in our show notes, because it has him riding through these crowds, whipping, like using the whip and with the thing, and everybody's sort of cowering from the whip and full on. And he still does that now.
Oh, wow.
It's been really like digging through mud, though, to find information about Brooke Mikey Anderson, Kim. As you can imagine, there's lots of references to her in the 80s and the 90s newspapers, but it's more like mentioning her in E Street, you know, like in the Here's What's on TV This Week and Brooke Mikey Anderson is in this. Mm. It's Win a Lunch with Brooke Mikey Anderson, or telling us a story of her birthday party or something like that, to which she invited Jamie Croft from A Country Practice, you know, that sort of stuff. She worked really consistently, though, after E Street for a few years. She did 7 episodes of Home and Away. She had a lead role in a series called Glad Rags. She did 51 episodes of Ocean Girl, 14 episodes of Treasure Island. And probably the biggest profile role that she did, and something we will have heard of, Kim, is that she did a guestie on Lost at about age 27.
There were a lot of Australians on Lost.
Oh, I just wonder what the connection was, because she was living in LA, I think, when she did it. Mm. I wonder what...
No, it was filmed in Hawaii, wasn't it?
Maybe.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was.
There must have been some Australian connection, like in casting or directing or something like that. So she worked pretty consistently, like I said, until about 2008. And by this time, I gather she's living in the US, because most of her work is American then. And she produced a zombie film called Detention of the Dead, and she directed a few short films under the name B.P. Anderson. And in around 2011, she appeared with Mel and Koshy on E Street, Where Are They Now?, and was talking about working in LA. And I'd have a clip from that, but it's actually pretty dull. It's actually not really that... It's not that interesting. It's just what I've told you now. You know, she's working in LA. I don't know quite what she's up to now. There's no credits on her IMDb since 2013. She's still got an active profile on IMDb Pro, but her websites are all down. So I think she might be doing something else now.
Mm.
The thing that I always do if I can't find anything about anybody around is I just go to their Facebook page. I find that. I
so creepy.
As I was creeping around Brooke Mikey Anderson's Facebook page, I thought, I don't know whether this is all that good in 2020 to be doing this.
I mean,
this,
I guess, but everybody else is doing it. It's just that you're doing it for this reason and other people are doing it for other reasons.
Exactly. So her last post on Facebook is from 2017, thanking her friends for her birthday wishes. I've got the feeling she's had a change of scene in some way.
If her last post was 2017, that to me sounds like she's just not super interested in social media.
Yeah. Well, I actually found a post that she said, one of her friends posted, and she said, "See, I told you I'm not very good at FB." Yeah.
And that's what people, if people were talking about me, that's basically would be the same thing. Her last post was in 2021. She shared A Country Podcast for the 5th time in a row, and that's all she ever posted.
Shall we think about meeting our other child actor of the day?
Yeah, we haven't said much about Penny Richards' contribution to this episode, have we?
No, we haven't, but she's really integral to getting Alex and Terrence together.
Well, tell me, am I going to be rich and famous?
It says you're going to marry a doctor and live with a little blonde girl and lots of animals.
Well, I'm not too sure about that.
It'll happen, Dr. Alex. It always comes true.
That's Emily Lightingwaite as a precocious pre-tween. Let's hear her now that she's all grown up. Mm-hmm. every child who watched you in ads and on A Country Practice is going to want to know, how did you get into being an actor as a child?
Oh, it's a funny story, actually. I would hate to say it, but now that I'm in my 40s, I think I'm allowed to say it without sounding like I've got a big head. I was awfully cute, and I had a really different way of talking, and I think my mum and dad just could see that I was very happy being in the limelight. Mum was at a shopping centre or something, and there was an agent there, and she went up and signed me up to an agency. And I didn't do anything for many years. And then in the mid to late 80s, I started with a commercial, and then it just kind of happened from there.
Did you enjoy being on set and learning lines and the like?
Oh, I loved it so much. Like, I think back to those days, and I remember, I don't think I realised how special it was to have that opportunity, but I loved being around the adults, and I really, I got a lot of energy from other people. And I remember going to auditions and like flying into this room of, you know, five adults sitting very intimidatingly at a table and going, my name's Emily Lighting and I'm here to tell you all about me. And, you know, like I really had, I had all the confidence in the world to be able to, you know, live up to what was expected of, you know, a young actress trying to find roles and everything in that age. It was, yeah, really good fun, really good fun.
Did you find being the only child on set, was that boring, or like, or did everyone's niceness kind of just make up for it?
I do remember there were times when it was boring because there's a lot of sitting around when you're filming, but I had an on-set tutor. So the entire time that I was filming, you know, there was a teacher there that was making me keep up with my schoolwork and, you know, making sure that I wasn't falling behind. So that kind of filled most of those gaps when all the other actors are, you know, smoking, laughing around.
Emily, what does it mean to be a child, like on a show, like in the rest of the world? Does it mean like less time at school, more pocket money, like more people recognising you? What did it actually mean to you at the time?
I think I was on set 3.5 days a week, and then I was at school 1.5 days a week. So there was a lot of time where I didn't have to sit in the classroom with my other classmates, which was a mixed blessing because obviously I didn't build the kind of friendships that the rest of the, you know, the kids had at school by being together all the time. But I did feel pretty special. Like even on those, on that half day when I had to come to school after filming all day, you know, I'd come with makeup all done and no one had packed me lunch. So the tutor would pick up McDonald's on the way to school. And so my school lunch was McDonald's and I, you know, I felt pretty special, but also a bit like an outsider.
What was it like for you at school, given that everybody watched A Country Practice?
I think there was a bit of a lag in the episodes going to air. So in the beginning, it didn't really change very much because, you know, they didn't really air the episodes until I think it was 8 or 12 weeks after we filmed them. So there were a few months where it kind of fell under the radar a little bit. And then everybody knew me at school. So it was, I was already, you know, just in. No one really cared who I was in those early days. But there was a moment where, you know, I went for an audition for a TV commercial and my mum couldn't take me. And this other girl who also was into acting, her mum drove us and I got the ad. And I remember feeling very sheepish that, you know, I wouldn't have even been able to be there if this girl's mum hadn't driven me and now I got the ad. So, look, I think, you know, as with everything, most kids were really nice to me. It was got really challenging when I started high school. So when I'd finished A Country Practice and then I was starting a new school, but A Country Practice was still on air. And that's when it became hard because teenage girls can be horrible. Yeah, I'd walk into a room of, you know, girls in year 10 or 11 and they'd all go, Dr. Alex, and make fun of my lisp. And, you know, I was at that stage where I was just starting to get really self-conscious about everything. And, you know, that was a really difficult time, that transition, because I didn't have the escapism of being on TV anymore, but I still had all that trauma of being recognised. And, yeah, it was an interesting challenge then.
Did you work much after A Country Practice? Is that as you were sort of transitioning into that high school time?
I didn't. That was really kind of like a line in the sand. So the producers said to my parents, she either needs to go full time or we need to write her out of the show. And Mum says that it was my decision. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me because I really wanted to start high school fresh. And I had this idea mm-hmm. that, you know, I wanted to make those friendships. I wanted to be normal like everybody else. I didn't want to be that kid that was the outsider all the time. Yeah. And I wanted to, you know, do well at school. And I was quite academic at that point. So
had you watched the show before you were on it? Did you know about it and know the characters?
I did. We weren't diehard fans, but I'd definitely seen episodes before. I mean, there wasn't anything else on television at the time. I mean, I try to explain to my kids now, you know, it's not like you had Netflix and you could just dial up any bit of content you wanted whenever. There were like two or three channels and, you know, you're either watching a country practice or, you know, 7:30 report on the ABC. Like there was very little options. So we definitely did watch it a bit as a family. And I watched, you know, Molly and the Chloe story, obviously. That was, you know, something that I think affected every Australian. I don't know, there'd be a single household that didn't participate in that in some way.
Yeah, yeah. So once you were actually in on set, what might an average day look like for you? I mean, did your mum have to go with you?
Part of the agreement with the producers of me being on the show was that I'd have someone that would come and collect me from home, and they'd be my chaperone and my tutor for the entire day, and they'd stay with me all day, take me through my lessons, and then they'd bring me back home again. Because both my parents worked, it wasn't feasible for them to be on set with me all day. And in the early days, before I was a recurring character, at that time they'd put me in a taxi with a cab charge to get home. And I mean, I remember being 7 years old, sitting in the back of a taxi, and I would write on a piece of paper, please call my parents. This is the number of the taxi driver. If you find this note, please just call my parents to make sure that I made it home. And I would hold it in my hand, ready to throw it out the window if the taxi driver took the wrong turn.
That's like, crazy.
Yeah.
Haven't times changed though? It's so, I can't imagine when my son was seven, him being prepared to get into a taxi by himself either. He just would have been terrified.
Well, no one even asked me.
Yeah.
There was no even, you know, are you going to be okay with this? Is it scary? You know, I don't even remember my mum saying to me afterwards, you know, do I get afraid? I don't even know if I told my mum the story about the letters.
Mm.
You know, like kids kind of weren't listened to the way they are now.
Yeah. I've actually just been watching some episodes today, and there's a scene where you're patting Spike the echidna, and I just thought, how amazing must that have been for you to just be able to hang out with those animals? And like, that's such a unique experience for a kid to be able to sit next to an echidna and pat it.
Yeah, and I remember telling people that I know what an echidna feels like, and that as long as you pat it in the right direction, you can pat an echidna. I remember holding Fatso and him being really heavy. but, you know, one of my clearest memories, and this is probably a bit of a dark one for a young kid, but so that Black Sheep episode, one of my first episodes, and I think Pinky was born, and Pinky was meant to be Inky, but Pinky came out white instead of black, and so they had to change the script. And the mum lamb that was meant to be, or sheep that was meant to be giving birth, was actually like arms and legs were tied together underneath it and tucked underneath it and heavily sedated. And I was like a seven-year-old kid with more empathy than anyone in the world and just sat with this little sheep all day. Mm. So I wouldn't even leave its side in between the scenes because I just felt so sad that it was like unable to move so it could be in this episode.
That's phenomenal.
When you were on set, Emily, who did you enjoy spending time with? Who was nice to you?
Look, definitely Joe. I remember just having such a great friend. I thought a friendship, but obviously, you know, she was so much older than me. You know, for me, I was like, oh, yeah, we're besties. But for her, it was probably something that she was doing quite, you know, altruistically. But, yeah, really enjoyed hanging out with her. And she actually took me to the movies once, and I remember she bought me a Christmas present and, you know, made it feel like we were friends.
Mm.
Di Smith, of course, Alex Fraser, she was exactly like my mum on set, and she took that role every step of the way. And still when I bump into her, you know, she always asks me how my mum is, because I think they kind of bonded that, you know, they were both raising me for a few years there.
That's so nice. When we do these chats with the actors, I guess we talk a lot about the significance of some of their storylines and things like that. Did you understand this, any of the significance of the storylines that you're involved with? Like, you know, being trapped in a car with you know, in a drink driving accident, or even the ones I've been watching now are the ones where you're trying to match make Alex and Terrence, and obviously they end up getting married. Did you have much of a concept of what impact your character had on the show?
Not really. And actually, in hindsight, I wish someone had kind of explained to me the whole story of the episode. Because I think that I was really just given my lines and I was told, you know, learn these lines. You know, I don't think I was really given that guidance to, you know, feel this. And, you know, I think so. And personally, I think you can see that in my performance, because a lot of the time I've just, you know, regurgitating lines and I didn't really know the impact.
I won't hear it. You're adorable. You're very effective.
Yeah. That's so cute. Look, the car accident scene, though, I have to say I do remember that really traumatically, because it was a hard couple of days to shoot that. They lowered the dashboard of the car onto my leg to be in that scene. And so I remember laying there for hours, even in between takes, and I couldn't move. It was freezing cold, and we were in Windsor, and we started at like the crack of dawn, because it had to have this kind of dawn kind of setting. And I remember being like, you know, it was quite traumatic. And my parents were on set on that day, and Dad really freaked out. He couldn't see me with all the, you know, scratches and things on my face. And when I watched that episode again, there's a cut right before it goes to the ad break, and it's kind of me looking through this shattered glass. You're not really sure if I'm alive or not. And my dad said that when he saw that, he just felt sick and he just didn't want to watch the show anymore.
That was one of my biggest memories of A Country Practice. In fact, I think it's the biggest memory I have of A Country Practice is you looking out that window, not knowing whether you were dead or not. Yeah, it stayed with me my whole life.
The producers of that show did such an amazing job to create that kind of emotion. You know, in every episode, there's always characters that you just feel so deeply for. So I feel really privileged to have been a part of it and be a part of, you know, something that made you think that you still remember, you know. Yeah. Since being on the show, you know, I went into marketing, I've done Fashion Week, and now I work in tech, and, you know, I've got a beautiful family and I love that this is a part of my story. In fact, I used to be embarrassed about it, and now people are like, did you know Amber's on TV? And they're like, oh, I'm going to find you, I'm going to Google you. I'm like, I will send you my showreel.
It's probably all going to come back around again now with 7plus and with the show sort of being accessible again too.
I've been making a joke that it's the Amazon.
That was so nice chatting with her. I felt like it was a really different perspective to what we've had before from actors, didn't you think?
I guess she was coming at it too as not really having an acting career to protect in a way. Like, not that the other actors haven't been really generous with us. They have been. But I guess it's your perspective as a kid on something is totally different from your perspective as an adult. So, yeah, she was fantastic. Thank you, Emily.
So, Kim, who's your pick for Fashions of the Field?
Well, do you know, I'm not actually going to go with a wearable fashion this week. I'm going to go with the accessory that every child either had or wanted in 1987, and that is Phoebe Spencer's Cabbage Patch doll. And do you know what? Hers is just like the one that I had, and full circle, Mel, mine was called Penny.
How fantastic.
Do you want to know why mine was called Penny?
Yeah, why was it called Penny?
Which Penny do you think I named it after of 1987? Not Penny from A Country Practice.
No, I'm just trying. I know there's another Penny. I'm forgetting.
She had a watch and she had an uncle with Go-Go Gadget arms.
Inspector Gadget's Penny, yeah. Oh, that's so great.
Did you have one?
I did, Kim. I had a real problem with dolls growing up, though, in that I had a real impulse control problem with cutting their hair.
Me too.
Did you really? Yes. Oh, my God. Did you used
all
to get a
doll? Dolls
oh
my had
God.
Their hair cut.
Yes, Kim.
My dolls and my little sister had haircuts by me.
And would you, I just didn't have, I did have a little sister, but I didn't think to cut her hair. Did you have that moment where you'd get a new, I can remember it really clearly, I'd get a new doll with beautiful hair and I'd think, this time I'm going to just leave her hair. Yes. I'm just going to leave it. And I think about it and I think about it, and every Barbie doll, everyone, and I'd end up cutting them. Yep.
And then it's just so disappointing.
Yeah. And it's like that, and that feeling of the cut, I can still remember the,
I remember giving my Barbie doll streaks with the ink from a pen.
Oh, wow, that's clever.
And I had a doll that I drew nipples onto because it was fabric. I gave it some boobs.
That's very racy.
What was your fashion of the field?
Can I bring it back to a great song that we spoke about? I can see every time that I see you run through me. It's a vision of you. Electric blue.
Brilliant.
I want to talk about Alex's electric blue dress that she wore out for her night with Terrence, because it was absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
Don't you think? She is the fashion icon of this part of the series. I love all of her
And I
outfits.
Love that she's a fashion icon who's cut from a completely different fashion cloth to Molly.
Totally. She's completely like fancy conservatoire fab. So I loved that outfit. I also loved the jumper situation throughout. It was pretty hectic all the way through. It was, even though it's November, it's winter in Wandon Valley.
Do you think it's ever summer in Wandon Valley?
No, it never is.
I've been looking at the jumper action on our Facebook page this week and thinking, does anyone ever wear a singlet in Wandon Valley?
We never see any arms or any boobs. We never see any boobs.
There's no cleavage in Wandon Valley.
Yeah, there's no cleavage. Esme would have nothing. Esme had some good dresses on as well in this episode. Well, Kim, we should wrap this up.
Yes, we will pop those pics on our Facebook page, which I didn't do last week. So I'll put them all on our Facebook page this week. That's A Country Podcast on Facebook. Mel, you're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter at Melanie Tait, T-A-I-T. Kim?
I'm sorry, it was a typo.
No, of course it was. Oh, no, I wasn't.
Melanie. I've written at Melanie T A I E. I do know how to spell
Melanie Tay. Melanie Tay.
It's so off the rails. And I'm at Kim Lester.
Huge thanks, as ever, to basically everybody who helps us put this together, including Chris, who is out with the kids right now.
He's such a legend.
Who knows where? He's such a legend. And thanks as well to Mike Pajanic for our theme music, Nate Edmondson for putting it together, and Emily Lidingwaite for chatting with us so generously as well. Oh, Kim, next episode, super exciting. Do you want to tell us about it?
Season 6, episodes 55 and 56, Listen to the Children. And if you don't already know which one that is, I think the super fans will know exactly what I'm talking about. Who was the big name guest that they had on episode 56?
I think it's my favourite episodes ever of A Country Practice. The big name guest is none other than the current PM of the time, Bob Hawke.
Bob Hawke.
I'm so glad it's only two episodes, and I'm so glad Bob Hawke's going to be on one of them.
And I'm definitely going to check before scheduling any more future episodes to make sure that they're just two-parters.
Oof, we can't be watching any of these four-parter, eight-parters anymore, Kim. Have a great week.
See ya.
Yeah, 2 weeks. Bye.